From you. Introduce our next speaker while we do a little computer switch at the same time, I think. Oh, we have a Mac, so we can just, okay, great. I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Tom Insel, I think probably 3-4 years ago at the NIH, when he had spent, I think, about 10 years as the director of the National Institutes for Mental Health. Obviously having a massive impact on the world, not just one organization there. Then he moved on to do something absolutely amazing, which is he went on to Google Verily Life Sciences, and then since then has moved on to create a new company called MindStrong, where they're actually learning how to use digital phenotypes to understand mental health. And it's interesting, because we've had these interesting career arcs. I had gone from a small company to corporate America to academics, and Tom's done the exact direction. We have all these scars we can show about that process, and that's what we were doing a couple months ago, and we saw each other again. And luckily, Tom has decided to dedicate some time. So welcome, Tom, up with a warm welcome for everybody.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Douglas.
Thank you, Sachin. I was just thinking about this, because you're right. We've gone sort of in opposite directions, and you look so much younger and happier than I am. So maybe I shouldn't interpret that as a psychiatrist, though we say, you know, that... nothing is left up to chance. There's a reason for everything. So I'm curious about that. There haven't probably been a lot of psychiatrists who've spoken to this group. So I was a little surprised when Sachin asked me to come talk here. But I began to realize that what he wanted to know about was something around this concept of how do we collect other kinds of data that could be meaningful for understanding outcomes, not the kinds of outcomes that we're used to, but these digital phenotypes, and I'll say a little bit about that. I first want to go back to something that Bob was talking about, which has to do with this, the way in which healthcare is changing, not because of the usual suspects, but because of a whole new group of suspects that haven't been in this field before. I live and work in Silicon Valley, so I now see the world from that perspective. And it's clearly made possible because we've got just an enormous amount of data that people can work with. We've got new forms of analytics around machine learning with high computational load, which have given us this opportunity for solutions. And frankly, the possibility that as these companies look at it, just as Bob said, with a $2.7 trillion market and the fact that they've been in many other spaces that have been successful, they got to be asking, wow, how do we take advantage of this enormous market? And even though we may be an IT company or we may be an advertising company like Google, can't we create solutions that will also spin off enormous value? The time I spent at Google, as Sachin mentioned, that was about a couple of years ago. I was part of the hatching of Verily, one of their Alphabet companies, just was Google, as Google was going through a reorganization. And it was really fascinating to come from the world of healthcare and the NIH to see how a company like that thinks. And one of the first things, well, several things hit me right away. One was that they think in terms of scale in a way that we don't think in terms of scale. So for us, a big study would involve a couple of thousand patients. At Google, if you're not affecting 1 billion people a day, you're still a work in progress. So that 1 billion a day is their measure of success. And they have 7 products that do that. There are 2 things about this that are really interesting. One of those is that every one of these products is free. And yet they generate enormous amounts of revenue. So it's a different kind of economics. It's a different business model than any of us have thought about before. The second thing about it, which I thought was fascinating when I got into the company, was that most of these were not what the company set out to do at all. In fact, advertising, which is what their real source of revenue is, was never in the original plan for Larry and Sergey when they set out to make a search engine. What was fascinating is that as they built the company, they hired lots of very young, talented people and said, hey, you guys are smart. We're going to give you 20% of your time to do something unrelated to what the company's interested in, but something you think with a passion could really make a difference. Most of these are 20% projects. Gmail, Chrome, all these things were never in the plan of the company. They were created by someone working at Google who who was given a day a week to work on something they thought would be cool. And that grew into a massive product line for the company. Again, in thinking about what Bob was saying, you know, how are we going to rethink the work set, the work that we do, rethink the organization, rethink the economy of what we have? These are really interesting models to begin to understand. It's not surprising that Google did get interested in healthcare, and maybe one of the best examples of their was their machine learning team called Google Accelerated Science, taking on this question of diagnosing diabetic retinopathy. And what they did is just a great example of what now one of these massively good AI companies can do. In this case, they were able to collect an enormous number of retinal images because, again, what they are really good at is it a cat, is it a dog? You know, looking at images and pulling out that signal that can tell them the final feature. That's, of course, what we want to do, whether it's in radiology or, in this case, for ophthalmology. And they were able to train this up on with working with a bunch of ophthalmologists, 54 ophthalmologists who rated a bunch of these images. They then trained an algorithm to be able to do this, and then very quickly were able to be better than the ophthalmologists, better than 90% of them, within about 3 to 4 months. So they ended up with what could be a potentially really interesting product using this approach with what's called now convolutional neural nets as a form of machine learning. It's just an example of how an advertising company could suddenly get into an area that could have a huge impact on the way we deliver healthcare. And it's not surprising that they're not alone, that lots of big tech companies have decided this is a place they want to be. This article from the end of last year cites that something like $2.7 billion being invested in 2017, that's 10 times more than were being invested by these same kinds of companies in 2012. That's a pretty big, pretty rapid increase. And it's going to change even more as Amazon, JP Morgan, and Berkshire Hathaway jump into this pool and say, is there something we can do that would look very different from the healthcare system that we have now? And I can tell you the way people in Silicon Valley think about this is they look for places that people are spending a lot of money and feel like they're not getting a lot of value. Or one way that people like to talk about it is they say, if you want to know where to innovate, look for duct tape. If you can find duct tape, you've got an opportunity to do something better. And then the argument has been, and I think it's the argument now at Amazon, is that the healthcare system is just loaded with duct tape and ready for some sort of innovation. Now, it's not just the big companies, these giants that Bob mentioned, like Alphabet and Amazon and Apple, all of which are deep into this space. But there's an enormous number of small companies that have joined in. Rock Health keeps track of this probably better than anybody. They count up something like 1,000 companies that have been founded in just the last 6 years, something like that, with about $22 billion in investment. And this curve is continuing to climb. So it's more in 2018 already than what we saw in 2017. So this is really kind of, I don't know whether to call it a Wild West or a gold rush or just a boom time, but there is enormous interest, partly because of the opportunity to have new analytics and, as Bob mentioned, the opportunity to have access now to digital data that have made this a very exciting time, and the sense that this is an area that's ready for true transformation. One of the ways which I've been really fascinated as I kind of try to understand this both from the inside and the outside is just the way in which this is changing the ecosystem. One way is that a huge part of this is happening outside the United States. And we are probably going to end up second or third place in being able to do this. In the same way that countries in Asia have just leapfrogged over whole areas or whole epochs of technology that we've gone through, like the credit card, which doesn't really exist in China. They've gone straight to using the technology that allows you to buy from your smartphone directly. So there are no credit cards there. In the same way, it's probably in China, Singapore, South Korea, where you're going to see the transformation of healthcare and the use of technology that will completely innovate in a way that's going to be pretty hard for us to do. We have this installed base that's very difficult for us to get beyond. And as you already heard, just too many forces that seem to be able to keep us from being able to make these changes. But already, when you just look at, if you follow the money coming into healthcare innovation and life sciences research, it's pretty interesting the way it's beginning to change. And these aren't perfectly accurate numbers, and they're always changing, but we're in a five-year period right now where you can see the growth of tech on the right, philanthropy certainly becoming much greater than it ever has been in the past. And the segment of this pie that's left to the public sector is becoming, even though NIH is getting more money than ever, it's actually not keeping up. We always knew that when I was at NIH, that no matter what we did, we weren't going to be able to keep up with the demand. We create demand there. But even within the entire context of where funding is happening for research in the life sciences, NIH, whether that's in the government generally, is becoming a shrinking sector when you've got a booming economy with so much venture capital money, so much philanthropic money that's being pumped into this. We could argue whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think the important piece for us to realize right now is it does change the culture of how science could get done. And I've tried to capture some of that here with the sort of traditional approach on the left, those of us who come from the academic sector, that's kind of our comfort zone where we write papers, we think about individual promotion and tenure, we stay as narrowly focused as possible, and we see all of this from an educational lens. That's a really different culture than this new culture, which either, you know, we used to say private sector, meaning the pharmaceutical industry. Now we're talking tech industry, and that is a very different sort of world. It's not just move fast and break things, which is not necessarily going to work for healthcare, but it is about creating products and not and thinking about profits. It's very much a team-oriented culture. So how do we bring together the right kind of designers and engineers and business development people all on the same team? And it's a place where things happen much more quickly. So we like to say that if academia is constrained by funding and parking, the private sector is really constrained by time. And they move very, very quickly. In this piece in Nature, I tell the story about how when I first joined Google, the end of November of 2015, I was there for 2 weeks. I went home back to Maryland, where my family still was, for 2 weeks around the holidays from about mid-December to beginning of January. And I came back, and there was a whole new product line that had been developed that wasn't there when I left. I thought, I'm not in academia anymore. This is a different world with a very different time scale. Now, one of the curious things is the bottom line here, because that has really changed in the last year or two, even since I've been in Silicon Valley, is this we call the tech lash, the shift from feeling like these guys, Facebook, Google, YouTube, these companies are like, you know, really the sort of gold standard for success. And now there's this concern that they are the really the gold standard for the erosion of privacy, lack of trust, and even sort of the corruption of what many of us had thought in terms of how they manage data. So part of what I want to leave you with in terms of how we think about this new ecosystem is that I don't think we've got it right yet. I don't think either one of these columns is ideal. We're going to have to figure out a way that allows us, I think, to move rather quickly and to create products and have this team culture, but does it in an environment of public trust. And it's a good thing for us to talk about how one does that and, of course, to invite as many stakeholders to that conversation as possible so that people can feel like they have some agency in how this develops. I want to take a few minutes and just talk about a very specific problem that I've been thinking a lot about. And I know it's not necessarily the problem you're thinking about, but I thought it would be worth going through this because it's maybe the leading edge of where all of this is going to happen in medicine. And that's the problem around brain disorders broadly. And I bring this up for really two reasons. One is that this is a place where, in spite of everything we've done and all the fantastic science, we actually haven't seen a change in morbidity or mortality. And we have a very, very high rate of both of those. I'll just quickly, just to kind of explain what I mean by that, if you look at the disability-adjusted life years, which is kind of the metric we use in public health to think about disability, you can see that mental disorders and neurologic disorders, when you put them together, represent more than a third of all disability, which is really surprising to people. But the reason for that is that the mental disorders begin really early in life. So about 70% have onset by age 25, or 75% actually, which is really different from most of the things that most of you see all the time, which are the diseases of the second half of life. But I tell you this because that means our patients or our users are from a very different generation. And they come to seek care in a way that is so different from the way their parents would seek care. There's a distrust of authority generally. There's a fascination with information broadly. And they expect to get goods and services conveniently, as if they're coming from Amazon Prime. Not even Amazon, just they want Amazon Prime. They want it the same day or next day. So the idea of like calling and making an appointment and waiting 3 weeks to see someone and having to go to their office, that's just like a non-starter for them. And we see this now because our patients are 22 years old. You'll see it in the world of heart disease, emphysema, all these other areas of the second half of life, but not too far into the future. And this goes back to Bob's point about, you know, we haven't felt the pressure yet because most of the people we see are comfortable with the brick and mortar world that we've built. But let me tell you, the people I see, the people who are in the mental health space, not so much. This is not the world they want. Or as I often tell my colleagues in psychiatry, they're not buying what we're selling. They don't want this anymore. And so this is like the, you know, the leading edge generationally of what I think we'll see throughout the entire life cycle. The other point about these illnesses is that although we don't tend to talk about them this way, they're highly fatal. In fact, they're more fatal than most things we deal with in medicine. The numbers are sort of stunning. About 45,000 suicides every year, more than twice the number of homicides. That's many more than the number of deaths from breast cancer or prostate cancer. It's most striking to me is that this hasn't changed in spite of everything we've done. So part of the concern here is that we have to do something quite different. And just one other comment, since we're talking brain disorders broadly, Alzheimer's, an enormously costly enterprise for us. And just, again, just in terms of demographics, a hugely increasing and costly public health problem. What we hope to do here is to get ahead of it in a way that will actually reduce the enormous costs, or this by itself will bankrupt the nation. Now, a question that I've often been asked when I talk about this is like, why have we done so badly here? You know, why is it that we can reduce fatality from acute lymphoblastic leukemia so dramatically, reduce mortality from HIV, from heart disease, now from stroke, and yet we're unable to bend the curve on suicide or on the disability of any of these mental disorders? I have at least four quick answers. One is that the diagnostic system is totally broken. The second, and this is one that I think is super important for you to think about, is that unlike the world of hospital medicine, most people with these illnesses are not in care at all. They're actually outside the care system. And that's part of what drives the high disability. We have treatments that work, but nobody actually either has access or is willing to use them. When they do get treatment, it's often really poor quality. And the thing that I want to focus on most of all, and what I think is relevant to you, is we don't measure well. And I can't stress this enough. that what's true in business is true in medicine as well, that we don't manage well what we don't measure well. And in our case, the measurement is really broken. Now, that is a place where technology can help us. When I talk about the technology revolution, I tend to use this table. I actually borrowed this originally from Francis Collins. We used to use this table for the genomic revolution at NIH a lot to show the changes in costs and the changes in speed of sequencing. But these are even more dramatic when you look at the numbers for how things have changed in the last 10, 11, 12 years in terms of access to information or technology. And the bottom line there around the change in analytics is even perhaps the most fascinating of all, this move to machine learning, either supervised or unsupervised, so collecting enormous amounts of data. And rather than trying to fit it into a particular kind of framework, allowing the data to generate its own classifiers, which is just incredibly exciting, and basically the way that that diabetic retinopathy story played out. Now, the part of this that I want to focus on is the top line around smartphones, because they've become so incredibly ubiquitous, and we tend to just take this for granted because we all use them. Many of you are using them right now as I speak, which is understandable. But what's phenomenal about this is just the power in this tiny device that you're carrying around in your pocket. When I was, it wasn't even when I was a student, but in the mid-90s, when I was already on faculty, the best computer any of us could hope for was the Cray 2 supercomputer, the most powerful computer on the planet. It was so powerful, it had to have its own cooling system, which required a whole separate room, which is why we estimate its weight at 2,500 kilograms, and its price at $32 million. So for those of you who complain about the price of the new iPhone, it's a bargain, believe me. But what's amazing isn't just the computational power of this thing in your pocket, but its ubiquity. I mean, it's just stunning to me that there are something like 3 billion of these in circulation on its way to 6 billion by the end of 2020, particularly in Asia. So when we think about health and we want to talk about global health, this is like the creation of the printing press. This is a really transformative technology because it's already in broad use. In fact, the problem is for most of us that it's not just in broad use, it's in too much use. So these numbers are stunning. 70 daily checks, 2,600 daily touches, meaning when you open it, what you actually do with it. And as it says here, more ubiquitous than clean water. Those numbers are a little bit out of date, and they're mostly collected in people over the age of 30. Under the age of 30, you go up about 5 to 10x. So it's kind of mind-boggling and actually very worrisome how much this piece of technology is being used. When I was at NIH, I spent a huge amount of taxpayer money, your money, trying to figure out how to use neuroimaging, especially task-based fMRI, as a biomarker for the diagnosis of a mental illness. In the best of all possible scenarios, that could be used by a few thousand people who might actually have required it and have benefited. Here we've got a technology that everybody already has, and they use too much. So the question is, can we use this technology, which is this very powerful computer, to get information that's worth something in terms of understanding someone's state of health? What we do today is pretty funky. Now, this is really loaded towards how we measure cognition or mood. But it's basically asking people, how are you feeling? And that's ironic because the people we're asking are by definition people who have a great deal of difficulty on just that problem of self-assessment. They have all kinds of bias built in to describing how they're feeling. So we don't collect anything objective. We simply take their subjective report, which is incredibly important, but you wouldn't stop there. It's like asking somebody who comes into the ER with chest pain to describe your pain without bothering to do an EKG or an echo. So what we need here is obviously something that fulfills these kinds of criteria, being objective, continuous, ecological, and To go back to something that Sachin was saying, something that's passive, so it's no burden, which is incredibly important if it's a tool you want to have people use for months or years. And in the world of chronic disease, that's what counts, is months, years, even decades. So it's got to be passive, which is why the phone is so incredibly attractive. Now, what part of this becomes useful? Well, you can certainly use the sensors, and you saw an example of that with the activity, so just getting step counts. Or you could use GPS, which we find most people really don't like because it feels like surveillance. They think it's really creepy, so we tend not to do it. Some people use just the metadata of calls in versus calls out or texts in versus texts out as a measure of social connections, amount of isolation. Turns out to be incredibly important in understanding the social support people often need to recover, particularly when they leave the hospital. Another amazing channel here is speech and voice, something that is ironically, you know, we call these things phones. Most people don't talk on them. In fact, there was a study done, a survey in the UK about 9 months ago, admittedly with younger people, with people between 20 and 30, and they asked in the survey, what do you do with this smartphone? And talking on it was number 11. So people are more likely to have their phone talk to them than to use their phone to talk through it to someone else. So there's actually a word for this now. It's called an anacronym, when you keep calling something the thing for which it has no relevance anymore. It's like when you send an email and you CC somebody, like it's a carbon copy that you're sending. That's an anacronym. Well, to call this a phone is an anacronym because voice and speech are not the main thing that it does, but it can do that. You can actually talk through the phone, and you then collect audio diaries or information that can be very rich for understanding somebody's change in mood, their cognition, in some cases, motor function as well. So very helpful for Parkinson's. I'm going to focus on a different piece of this, which is called human-computer interaction, or HCI, and it's weird. It has to do with just how you hit the keyboard, how you type, how you tap, how you scroll. This was developed by a guy who founded our company named Paul Degum when he was in the world of cybersecurity. So he was the CTO of a cybersecurity company here in the Valley, and his task was to try to find hackers when they'd move from North Korea to the Ukraine, back to Russia, wherever they would be. They kept changing their addresses, and he discovered that he could track them by their pattern of typing. It was what he called a digital fingerprint, that they left this digital fingerprint no matter what machine they were using or where they were doing it from. And this became the leading forensic tool in cybersecurity. It has resulted in massive court cases with huge settlements. His company, fortunately for me, but unfortunately for him, was bought out by a much bigger company. He's a startup kind of guy. He didn't want to do that. He happened to be a cardiovascular surgeon in an earlier lifetime. So he thought, maybe I could do something in healthcare. It was time to come back to healthcare. So he said, could we use this to understand something about how people think or how they feel? So he collected the same kind of data. It's mostly reaction time driven data. And then with machine learning was able to map that onto some gold standard cognitive tests to create what we call this digital phenotype. Now, ideally, you could use all of these channels together, the sensors, the keyboarding, the voice and speech, to get this phenotype. In our experience, oddly enough, that human-computer interaction stuff tells you most of what you need to know, so that's pretty powerful. There's another channel that feels a little more creepy. We don't do it, but you could, because it's loaded with information. It's called the digital exhaust. And it's all the stuff people put on their phones through social media, their search history. It's obviously funky to start looking at someone's search history. On the other hand, Google provides a tool called Google Takeout. You can Google that, and you can find Takeout, especially if you use Chrome. And it's fascinating. Do it on yourself, because what you'll go back and you can look at 9 months or a year of your search history. And it's like looking at old photographs or looking at an old diary. You think, hey, that can't be me. But it's all there, and it's amazingly revealing about where you've been over the last year by looking at your search background. There's also the possibility of getting data off of the AI personal assistants. All of that, many people feel, is like surveillance. It feels really creepy. We don't go there, but those are powerful sources of information, and in the right context might make a lot of sense. What we do is something really simple. As I said, it's taking off these signals about how you type, not what you type, and it's getting that reaction time information, and then there's a whole series of transformations we can do because these are time series. We're looking over the course of a day, and there are lots of ways to validate this with sort of classical clinical trials. The kinds of things we've done, just to give you a feel for the data and what you might expect if you want to get into this space, this is looking at cognitive performance. So it's maybe hard to read, but these are like classic neuropsychological tests like verbal memory tests, attention tests, executive function tests. And in blue is the performance of about, I think, 27 people when they were evaluated in a 3 to 4 hour battery at Stanford. The red is what we pulled off as a digital biomarker by looking at about 80 or 100 of those different potential biomarkers that we can get off of this human-computer interaction. So it's sort of intriguing that it's a good way of mapping cognitive traits. We can also use it to look at mood states. This is a study of outpatients in a depression trial and showing again with the blue being their depression score and the red their digital biomarker. It's pretty remarkable that we're able to get these measures that actually fulfill what we wanted, something more objective, something that's continuous. So we get this every day. As long as people use their phone, we get the data. It's ecological in the sense that it's not in the clinic or in the hospital. It's capturing them in the world where they live. And what's fascinating is it's often how they're doing at 3 o'clock in the morning that's much more important than how they were at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when they were in the clinic. In a way, it's like looking at labile hypertension. You get this, this remarkable and previously unseen picture of someone's 24-hour schedule day after day. And again, to go back to Sachin's point, it's totally passive, which we think is critical. Now, the other thing I'll mention about this in terms of, and I'd like to wrap up pretty quickly here so we can have some discussion, is that you can use the same platform, the phone, in an interventional sense as well. So I've been talking about just this one piece of the story of the phenotyping. We call it the afferent loop, collecting data to get that kind of information. But particularly in the mental health space, there's all this opportunity to deliver psychotherapy or psychosocial treatments, and you can completely transform the way care is given through better care management. You can build dashboards. You can put in quality metrics. You can keep track of information in a way that this field has absolutely not done because they don't measure anything. So the opportunity to create really what is a kind of learning engine or closed-loop system, very much the culture of the technology world, which is always putting something out there and learning as quickly as possible about what works and what doesn't and improving it on a daily basis or weekly basis. I like to tell people that every time you do a Google search, even today, when you do a search, you're part of 150 experiments. Some of those experiments will last 2 hours and will have data from 10 million people. That's a different kind of science, but it's a science that we can learn from, I think. And it is part of this concept that you're always changing, always perturbing the system and learning as a result and getting better and better. These are not worth going into in any detail, but just to give you a sense of what these kinds of things look like on the phone, both for the diagnostic side, the afferent loop of collecting the data, being able to map it out so people can see their own data, and then providing information to a care team so they can see as well. There are other opportunities here, and this is getting to Bob's point about how we change the way the work is done. And the reason I'm here and the reason I wanted to kind of describe this is because I do think it's going to happen in mental health before it happens anywhere else, partly because it's just so bad the way we do it now. So in mental health space, a huge problem is suicide, as I mentioned before. So creating something like a crisis text line that allows anyone anywhere to text this number and to get help within 30 seconds or 90 seconds. They're on the line with a trained volunteer. It's text, it's not phone, because as I mentioned, young people don't use this to talk on. This allows them to still be anonymous, but it also allows them to get responses very quickly. Huge source of data as well, and this company, or it's actually a nonprofit, Crisis Text Line, has now partnered with a whole number of academic sites to try to just like, it's like getting the mood temperature of the nation. They can look, you know, after a big storm like we're in the middle of in Florida, and they can map what are the, who's in crisis, and what are the issues, and at what time of day, and at what age. So they, even though it's anonymous, they can get these population pictures about what's going on. The other piece of it, which to me I think is really what I've been thinking the most about, is with this next generation coming along, how do we meet them where they are? Seven Cups is a really interesting company. Full disclosure, it's my daughter's company. So you heard from Bob about his son doing Moneyball. My daughter said, you know, nobody wants to come and see guys like you. They want to help each other. So she set up this peer support effort, which is now serving 2 million people a month. Last year, I was asked to do a talk at in Sacramento for the California legislature about innovation in mental health, because they have a bunch of bills on this topic. So I called her and I said, hey, sweetheart, what's the story in California? Have you got users in California? And she said, hold on just a second. Actually, I have to confess, I didn't call her, I texted her. And she texted back in about 5 minutes a table of every county in California and the number of users they'd had over the previous 12 months. And the total at the bottom was 545,000. I thought, that seems like a lot. That's really a big number. What's the number? It's a free service. So what's the number of people in the brick and mortar mental health care system that we spend $8 billion a year for in California? Well, I didn't have anybody to text about that. It wasn't available through any Google search. So I took about 2 weeks to paste numbers together. It was never perfect, but the highest number I could get to was about 450,000. So they're already connected to more people online than we're connecting to offline. Now, what are they? They're peer support services. They're like AA. AA married to Facebook. Basically, people come on the site, they find other people who have a similar issue. They come on saying, I'm suicidal, I'm depressed, I'm anxious, whatever it is. And what's most powerful about this, a little bit like AA, is that very quickly you go from a person who's seeking help to a person who's giving help. And that turns out to be perhaps the most therapeutic thing you can do. They've also built in coaching, they've built in online therapy, a whole range of skill set kind of approaches. So I don't know if this could be like Airbnb, and maybe all of us are like Hilton and Marriott or Hyatt. It's hard to say at this point, because I think it's still early, but it's fascinating to realize that they're growing about 19% month on month. I don't think that's true of any other part of the healthcare system that I know about. So this could be something coming to you. So just to close out, what I said was we have this set of problems. In our field anyway, I think we're going to see these solutions coming out, partly because of better measurement, partly because of the ability, like Seven Cups, to do this anonymous, person-centered online care. Quality is becoming much easier to manage when you have insight into the data, when there's transparency, and this lack of measurement, I think, is going to be the first thing that we'll be able to fix. A lot of people have asked me, and this usually comes up in questions, like, do people really want this on their phones? And often they don't. We call it a digital smoke alarm, but what we've discovered is that if you've had a fire, or you love somebody who's had a fire, then you want a smoke alarm. And that's where it seems to be most useful, is in building this for within the healthcare system, not as a consumer product. I want to finish with this one slide, which I think is sort of like what Bob was saying. I think we're still very early on. This is I love that that quote he had from Eric Brynjolfsson about the productivity paradox and how it just takes a lot longer than you think it should take. And I think that's true here. When I left NIH to come to Google, I actually had no idea what I was getting into. I didn't own a hoodie. I didn't like drive a Tesla. I didn't, you know, I had watched the TV series Silicon Valley thinking, well, maybe I'll learn something from that. And everybody, when I told people that, they all laughed. When I got to Google, somebody said, oh, you know that's a documentary, right? So to prepare, I actually went to talk to some friends who had built a very large and very successful tech company in, of all places, Reston, Virginia. And they were just selling it at that point and becoming very, very wealthy. But before that, I said to them, what do I need to do? And this was a husband-wife team, and she was really great. She said, it's just so easy to be successful. You just have to do two things. The first is you've got to build a product that has value. And I said, well, you mean it makes money? She said, no, I'm not talking about economic value. I'm talking about social value, something that does the three E's. It gives you efficacy, that is, it fixes a problem that people will engage with, they'll use it. And the third, which is like the most important, is it's efficient. It has to not just provide more data, it has to save more time. If you're creating data that creates work for people, that's a non-starter. People don't need more data, they need more time. They need to be able to make decisions better, faster. And she said, if you've done that, you're not quite halfway. I said, well, what's the other part? And she said, the other part's much harder, but more important, and that's trust. You've got to build this in a way that people will feel it's transparent, that they have some agency in it, so you're building it with them, or they see it as creating, as Sachin likes to say, it's their data, not your data. And you've got to show that your handling of that data is being done with a keen eye to privacy protection and responsibility, just like you would want for your own data times 10. She said, look, this sounds like maybe it's overwhelming and complicated. I'm going to make it really easy because she knows I'm not that smart. She said, here's all you need to do. Just like as a North Star, keep this in mind. You're building something to empower patients and families with information. If you just do that, you make that your North Star, that's what you're after, you'll come out, I think you should come out on the right side of this. But you can't lose sight of the value and trust at every stage of development. So I'll leave you with those thoughts. Hopefully that's relevant to where you're going here with MPOG, and look forward to your thoughts and questions. Thank you.
We do have time for questions. If people have some questions, they can go to the mics.
Hi, I'm Becky Schrader from Duke. Several years ago when I was doing my master's in informatics, one of our assignments was to create a killer app that was supposed to transform healthcare, and our idea was similar to what you have, what you are talking about, although they told us we couldn't do it because of the sandboxing that was built into the iPhones at the time. But the segments that we were interested in addressing the segments of the market were a little bit different, and I'm sort of interested in your thoughts about these particular ones. And one was parents who were concerned about the teenagers getting involved in substance use, and the other was children of elderly parents and the safety of them living alone.
Yeah, those are two really great targets, I think, and great opportunities. Almost every time I talk about this, I hear from parents who've had kids who've just gone off to college, often kids who have struggled a bit in high school, and then they don't hear from their kids for days on end, and they worry. And they would love to have something like this. This I think it's a real problem, though, to go in that direction, because it becomes a kind of surveillance. I think it violates that trust issue. I mean, not for the parents, but for the young person. So we want to think about, in doing this, how one does it that is that pays appropriate attention to that agency part and giving people the chance to get the data in a way that those who are collecting the data would want it and can see it. The second issue, though, of using this for on the other end of the life cycle for people with aging parents, I think makes a lot of sense. The problem with that is that until very recently, older people didn't use their phones that much. And that's the biggest problem with this, is that even when people get severely depressed, they stop charging their phones, so you don't know about it. It could be really helpful to get the data before that and intervene before that happens. But all of this is contingent on people who like to text or like to use their phones for all sorts of communication. Absent that, we get no data. So that could be a problem. Although I've seen some more recent use data that says that smartphone use is way, way up in the over 70 group, maybe because they're communicating with their grandchildren. I don't know, but it'd be interesting to see how that changes.
Hi, Douglas Kuhn, University of Michigan. I'm an ICU physician, and I've observed recently the uptake of patients using their phones while in the ICU. So it's usually a good prognostic sign if they're using them successfully. However, I've also noticed that patients who are beginning to become delirious, this is actually a fantastic use. And I had a patient, and a team were moving around to round on him. He had his phone out in his hand. It was upside down. It was backwards, but he was trying to enter his PIN number or his passcode. And then similarly, I had another patient later on that week on service who, at the beginning of the week, had got herself locked out of her phone because she'd entered her passcode so many times. But at the end of the week, texting with her was actually the best way of communicating with her. What kind of space can you talk about, or can you talk about how these types of technologies are emerging in the acute care context? Because that's maybe a little bit different from what we've talked about
so
far today.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I don't think we have much experience with that. I mean, in the mental health space that I come from, one of the obvious things is that the first thing you give up when you go into a hospital is your phone. I was recently visiting a hospital here in the East Bay, Fremont Hospital, where they have a very large adolescent unit. And I was told that the highest incentive for people to leave, the adolescents to leave, was to be able to get access to their phones. And that was what was often driving them to get discharged early. But in the acute medical context, I don't know. I don't have a sense of how much the patients themselves are on their phones versus the family members around them who are probably texting or searching or doing something constantly while they're sitting there, which could be actually an interesting source of data by itself. But not clear to me that this is necessarily as useful as a wearable or a CGM or something like that that would be more relevant in that context.
Danny Mutschlegel, Brigham and Women's Hospital. Wondering, how many patients are we actually missing with this digital revolution? You alluded to the older folks while I was waiting in line here to ask the question, but what about those with mental illnesses? Walking to the hotel this morning, there are a lot of people lying on the side of the street with significant mental illnesses. They do not have a smartphone. What about those lower socioeconomic class that cannot afford a data plan, don't have access to this technology? Are we missing those in our clinics when they see the flyer in the pre-op clinic? Will they take the flyer, or they can't afford it because they don't have a phone or they don't have access to data?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And we call this the digital divide, you know, the problem that there'll be this disparity because of access to technology. So I have two answers to that. The first one came about in January of this year. My wife and I were on safari in Tanzania, and we ended up with a really great guide, and we said, hey, you know, we're interested in learning a lot more about the people here as well as the animals. So we took off a few days and went to a really remote area of northern Tanzania in what's called Maasai land. And we were hiking up on some hillsides where there were Maasai warriors with their sheep in these beautiful red shuka robes. And I couldn't believe it, because every one of them was packing a phone. And I thought, wow, this is like almost unbelievable. So we stopped through translator, said, what do you do with this? And I was stunned. I mean, the first thing he said, literally, the first thing he said was, I love the Chrome browser. It's like, I thought, you know, this is a culture that up until a generation ago was pre-literate, never went to school, and now every shepherd's got, he's on the Chrome browser. And it's also a culture in which there's this intense connection with the young men who went through the coming of age ceremony at age 13. They all go through it together. It's very dramatic. And they stay together, even though they're shepherds in very distant parts of Tanzania. They stay connected like an extended family. He said, Facebook is great. We got Facebook for that. So I was just fascinated by that. So on the one hand, the digital divide is not the global disparities that we used to think about. But there are these pockets. And so to answer the question about like homeless people, and you're in ground zero for that. Like this neighborhood in particular is probably one of the worst homeless areas in California and maybe in the country. And there have been some surprises to that. A is that people with severe mental illness who are maybe walking around with shopping carts and have very little else will value their phone more than anything else. They do have phones. They're not iPhones, but they'll be usable phones. They may not be smartphones, but often they are. It's difficult for them to have a data plan, but if they can, they'll swing it because it is the most important connection they have in a way that I just didn't believe. So I thought when I was at NIMH, we got a bunch of applications of people who wanted to use this kind of smartphone data for people with serious mental illness. And I said, this is stupid, right? A, they don't have them, and B, they won't use them. And C, they're already paranoid, and you're going to be, you know, monitoring everything they do. How's that going to work? And I was so wrong. A, they did have them. B, they prefer to communicate asynchronously through text and not face-to-face. So it is the most comfortable way for them to link to other people as well as to therapy. And C, yeah, they're paranoid, but they assume you're monitoring them anyway. So this just makes it transparent. But that's not to downplay your point. I mean, there are people, and you'll see them in this neighborhood. I was actually thinking about that this morning as I was walking around, because I'm staying at another hotel, that it's actually a question I should be asking, because we don't engage people on the street, but to find out if they do have phones and if they, you know, which ones. And the way I was doing in Tanzania, we should probably ask the same question here. By the way, one little thing about that Tanzanian experience. I got so into this, I thought, like, where do you get a phone? Like, you know, it doesn't drop out of the sky, although I learned last night there is a service that does that called Zipline, very interesting company in Central Africa that drops things like that out of the sky. But these people have actually set up kiosks in the closest thing to towns. There are no paved roads, but there are settlements. And I went to the closest kiosk in a place called Karatu, Tanzania, and the kiosk was called Mr. Barack Obama Cell Phone Store, which I thought, man, that is really interesting. No Trump Tower here, but we got... Anyway, last question.
Thank you so much. This is Nirav Shah from MPOC. Thank you for a wonderful talk. I do have a question. You talked about passive data collection and its potential for creepiness. And, you know, we've seen that in the Prosper study a little bit, that it can seem creepy at times. And, you know, one of the things that we're thinking about are there active mechanisms of data collection that still engage the participant, still would want them to be able to use those, but don't necessarily have the creepiness of passive data? Gamification, easy surveys, you know, there's several options. But have you guys thought about that at Mindstrong, and what are your thoughts
on
that? Yeah,
we do. So we use flash surveys a lot. And, you know, we're doing a big study of post-trauma, of level one trauma victims. We have 5,000 patients that we're following from the ER, from the ICU, post-hospital. And there we use flash surveys. And we've gamified them to make them quick and, like, not too funky for people. It is a problem going long-term. I think, you know, that starts to get really wearing on people. Plus, it's not clear that
The repetition effects don't wear out any of the value of the data, so people just start to open it and, you know, it's like spam after a while. What I think you can get around the creepy aspects of passive data collection in a couple of ways. One is what we do has no content. So we're not, you know, it's not what you type, but how you type. So if someone were to even have that stolen and hacked, it's uninterpretable, except it's reaction times, and that's not that interesting. The second way is to really engage people at the outset with what it is you're collecting, and so that they truly understand it and they understand why it's being collected, and give them some choice. So what we do is we have a little menu. It says, these are the things we can collect on your phone. You tell us which ones you would be comfortable with, and then we recheck every like month, and they can like opt out of any of those. I think that's good because it reminds people what they've consented to, and it gives them some agency over this process. But I got to say, this is going to be a big issue still. I think the sense that this is surveillance is going to be hard to get around. And then, you know, I mentioned all of the innovation in China. In China, they've created this thing, the social credit score, where there's enormous amounts of information that they are that is tracked. And that goes on to, I have a slide, I didn't put it in this deck, that gets can be displayed publicly about, you know, who in your village has a different social credit score. And, you know, that's actually acceptable in China. When I talked about this in China, people said, yeah, so. But we, you know, in this country, I think that's going to be a really tough, you know, having that hang over us. We've got to maintain a very different frame around this, that it's around helping you to manage your health by giving you information that is yours in a way that you can use. And I think if we do that well, we can still stay within that trust space. Okay, thanks very much.